Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
I knew at 4 months that something was wrong. One of his eyes quivered, his left eye. And I breastfed both my boys, and Alex, at 4 months, ought to have been able to begin to focus on me. The distance between my breast and his eyes is about, less than a foot. But at that stage, the baby, should be able to focus in quite closely and see the person that's closest to them, which is mother. But his eye quivered. This just struck me as wrong. And so I went and had his eyes checked by an ophthalmologist who said that his eyes were just fine, nothing to worry about. 11 months into his life, he had still not been able to sit up on his own. He was not able to crawl. He was not able, it seemed to me, to focus properly on things that were close up. So he didn't go through that stage that so many children go through, which is to examine the hands or to examine the feet when they're lying on their back and sort of play with them. So we went to see a developmental optometrist who suggested that his left eye wasn't working properly, and so we patched the eye, the right eye, in order to encourage the left eye. And at the urging of an ophthalmologist, we put Alex into glasses, having discovered that he was very farsighted, namely, he could not focus close up. So we thought that we had tackled this problem very effectively, because as soon as we put the glasses on, Alex was able to see more clearly. So we saw him examining his hands and taking in toys and playing with them and so on. I wish it had been that easy. It wasn't. It became more complicated.
From a parent's perspective, how can we best advocate for a child with disabilities? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest has shared a story from her own life with you at the beginning of this program. Dr. Sari Hornstein is an historian and former PTA lecture program chair at the Ivy Mount School in Rockville, Maryland. She's a regular contributor to Washington Parent magazine and has devoted her efforts to exploring the mysteries of the special needs child. Her articles have addressed a diverse range of topics, including the theory of sensory integration, communication disorders, legal issues relating to special needs families, as well as the educational implications of No Child Left Behind for typically developing as well as special needs students. She's the mother of two boys, one an 18-year-old freshman at college, the other a 16-year-old with special needs. Welcome back to Parents' Perspective, Dr. Hornstein.
Thank you very much for having me. It's great to be back.
Do you want to talk a little bit about Alex's issues?
We were living abroad in his first year, and we came back to the U.S. There was some question as to whether or not he had water on the brain because he had a very large head. He was sitting up, but he wasn't very firmly positioned there. You know, you sort of felt like he might tip over any time. And he started to crawl, but we also noticed that there was another issue. He would crawl, and most children, when they crawl with their hands flat out so that they're taking in an enormous amount of information through their fingertips. Alex would crawl with his fingers totally closed as though he were making a soft fist. And I remember about a year and a half into his development, so he's still not walking, I went to visit my parents who were in Florida at the time, and we put some sand into Alex's hand so that he would play in the sand. And he puked. He just retched. He hadn't put any sand into his mouth. He was so utterly unaccustomed to feeling the sensation in his fingertips that he was overloaded, sensorily overloaded. So it was clear that things were not quite right. And so, I mean, by this time, he also continued to have this very large head, and he had what they call now, it's commonly known as very low tone in the body. He was quite a floppy baby at this stage. So all of this sort of physical imbalance, coupled with low tone, coupled with the visual difficulties, he couldn't see well close up, so he would tilt his head back to create more distance between himself and the things that he wanted to focus on. So he was sort of quite awkward in the way in which he managed the world, but it made perfect sense. What happened eventually is that I made a connection with somebody who knew of a developmental optometrist working in Washington, D.C., and this was probably the single most important thing we did for Alex in his second year of life, which was to put him into a new pair of glasses. And so what this doctor did is he put Alex into a set of prisms that had the effect of getting Alex to pull his head forward instead of allowing it to fall back. Within a half an hour of being in these new glasses, Alex was able, he's now probably 3 years old, he was able to run up a mulch heap at a playground without falling over. I used to be strict Secret Service at all playgrounds because I never knew when he might falter. And if he, and of course the playgrounds have hard equipment and he could bang his head or hurt himself pretty badly. So I used to be very, very close. Well, he ran up this mulch heap and he ran down without falling. And what happened in that instance, within a half an hour, is his head was pulled up. It didn't always stay there because he didn't have a lot of muscle tone. But once the head was positioned correctly on the spine, the shoulders dropped and the arms started opening up. And then we bombarded him with sensory input through sensory integration techniques. Another part of the story. But this was the single most important thing, because once we had him physically more balanced, it was possible to start working on other things.
That's a helpful note for parents, that if you can get someone, a doctor or someone who is developmentally tuned in to these kinds of issues, then you can get into the kinds of therapies that the child needs.
There is no question that the longer you wait, the harder it will be, and the earlier you get in, and in some cases as young as 2 months, 3 months, there are people who know which reflexes to look for and which are sort of advanced warning signals about likely developmental problems down the road.
We'll take a short break and be right back to continue our discussion on advocating for your child with disabilities.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Sari Hornstein about advocating for your child with disabilities.
Dr. Hornstein, could you discuss with us a little bit some of the variables involved in mainstreaming versus special classes for children with different kinds of problems like you've described?
When Alex was born and I discovered there were problems, I imagined for the best part of 5 years, maybe a little longer, that he was going to snap out of it. Okay? So when he was ready for school, I was convinced that he was just going to be fine. The Child Find Services in the county in which I live were directing me towards all sorts of remedial programs, preschool, and this was very useful. But, of course, I did not really believe that this was going to be necessary over the long term, and I gradually came to realize that there were problems here that perhaps Alex wouldn't snap out of, but eventually we would be able to overcome some of these difficulties. So I fully believed that he would be available for learning in a regular kindergarten eventually, and first grade and so on. Well, this became clearly not the case. I tried a program where he did a half day of special education and a half a day in a regular nursery. And this was good, and I was encouraged to do so because there were so many behavioral potential benefits for his being in the company of ordinary children. It didn't turn out quite that way, and I found a school, and they worked with him very closely on sensory integration issues, and so the consequence over the long term is that Alex has no trouble playing with sand, although he doesn't particularly care for it. He still won't eat certain textured foods. He just doesn't like them, and I've stopped even trying to persuade him to try. But in many ways, his sensory system and his visual system have grown to such an extent that at the age of 14, he finally learned how to ride a bike. That tells you something about where he came from. So the child who couldn't walk at the age of two is now riding a bike, and his longest distance now is 35 miles. He's fit and he's strong and so on. So that's very nice. So what we have here is a situation where he found a school which addressed some of these needs. Now, once he was there, I kept thinking every year when we had to review the placement, because the school system, by rights, and I support this entirely, reviews the progress, the educational, social, developmental progress of each child that's placed, particularly if they have an IEP, which stands for an individualized education plan. The individualized education plan is a plan which is an extremely detailed document which is drawn up for every child who has special needs of one kind or another, which address a great range of issues, behavioral, social difficulties, developmental issues, educational challenges that a child might have, special accommodations and special teaching techniques that ought to be targeted to that student so that that student can make progress. Now, the county agreed in our case that the county special need programs, which exist within ordinary schools, could not accommodate Alex for one important reason, and that was that he was also incontinent as he was 5 and 6 and 7 and 8. He could not, he was so easily distracted by whatever came his way that he'd forget that he needed to go to the bathroom. Well, the county couldn't deal with this. They just didn't have enough staff. This special school did have enough staff. It was not a problem. They could cope with Alex. And I remember listening to parents, because I went to a bunch of meetings and tried to learn what I could, that these parents felt that this separate facility offered their children the opportunities to be typical. What does that mean? Mm-hmm. Well, if my child who has developmental disabilities is at a regular high school and wants to run for school president, who will ever elect them to a school president post or to a class representative post or to the honor council? But if my developmentally disabled child is in a setting where there are other kids like him or her, then the possibilities exist for him to have a full and rich experience. I had never heard this articulated before. Not all children are mainstreamable. Many are. In the case of children who are socially very adept, but who have academic difficulties of one kind or another, another argument can be made that these kids ought to be mainstreamed because they don't seem to be bothered particularly by their lesser academic abilities. What really motivates them and makes them feel like they belong is the opportunity to make friendships and do things, and some of these things they can do. In the case of my son, he's in a very, very wonderful special needs setting where he's with 10 other children and he has learned a number of things. One, he has a sufficiently small classroom without distractions for him to be able to do work. But he's also developed something else only very recently. And that's the sense, and this is only in the past 2 years, I might add, because he has lived in a kind of mentally isolated world, the value of friendship. Because all the other kids in his class also have issues. But he doesn't regard them as particularly unusual. I mean, he's got his own. They've got theirs. But so-and-so is my friend. And he's developed this sense that he belongs in this classroom. The ultimate question is, what are reasonable expectations to have without going too far into the future? And a good school system will be able to accommodate many different needs. And, you know, in the county that we happen to live in, there is a great spectrum of services offered. You can have a totally mainstream kid, partially mainstream kid, kids that are taken out for part of the day in order to be able to work on things that they need, kids who are, in my case, who are in separate facilities. Which one's right? That will be for the parent to figure out in the context of the available options and in conjunction with good, thoughtful teachers.
And one of the main points that you've made along the way is you're constantly reevaluating with the people that are helping you do this reevaluating.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And I think the major thing that parents need to get from all this is do your homework, know what's available so that you can know what your options are. And then when you sit down with the experts, and you, of course, are an expert as well because it's your child, you can evaluate what can be the possible outcomes.
There's one caveat here. What does it mean to be an expert? You know, I know things now that I didn't know 10 years ago. And there was a time when I kicked myself. If only I had known then, maybe, right? This is a very easy trap to fall into. So this is why I said perfectibility and expertise go together. There's only so much you can take in any one moment. There are so many different options out there. There's so many things to think about. It's very hard to know how to evaluate what's most important and at what time. And I guess the most important thing to bear in mind is you can't know everything at the same time. You can only know a certain amount, and then you have to give yourself enough slack to say, I made the best possible decision that I could given the information that I had at the time. And that's all I could have done regardless, and then you take it one step at a time. I would advise parents, though, to look seriously, particularly those parents with very young children, even those with older children, that this sensory motor piece is such an essential part of being able to navigate the world. And without some attempt to try and understand what it means and then see how your child develops, that child will be ill-served over the long term. Bearing in mind, I mean, in my opinion, whether or not, you know, a child has a high-powered job or makes great success or whatever is not as important as being able to feel comfortable in his or her own skin, to be able to walk, to be able to go and cycle, to be able to enjoy basic parts of life, I mean, and to be able to communicate and do things with other people. It seems to me that this connection is a building block for everything else. Once you've got those, you know, foundations set, then other things follow.
Could you identify for us what are the rights of a disabled child in most school systems?
All children are entitled to a free and appropriate public education. Individuals with Disabilities Education Act also mandated that children with disabilities are entitled to a free and appropriate public education.
That's a federal law.
Yeah, yeah. How this is interpreted, of course, depends on states, because it's the state that develops the program for educating the child, even though there are certain guidelines that are set by the federal government. So our children are entitled to a free and appropriate education. The question is, what exactly does that mean? Does it mean that they're entitled to the best available education? Does it mean that they're entitled to an adequate education? Well, there are some real disputes at the center of this now, where parents who have argued that their children ought to be placed in one school as opposed to another because they think that that school is better have been denied the rights to shift their children on the grounds that it is not mandated that the child get the best available education. It is simply mandated that the child get an appropriate education. So this is a very tricky problem. Now, what's interesting is that No Child Left Behind is the latest legislation to come down from the feds, from the federal government, and it mandates, and I quote, from the Federal Register, that schools are held accountable for educational results so that the best education possible is provided to each and every student. So here we have a situation where appropriate seems to apply to kids with special needs in the special education law, whereas best applies to No Child Left Behind. As everybody knows, appropriate and best have very divergent meanings. And the question is, how do you interpret the law and do what's best for the children involved?
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on advocating for your child with disabilities.
For an audio cassette copy of Any Parent's Perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Sari Hornstein about advocating for your child with disabilities.
There are civil rights and there are community resources that ought to encourage the embracing of everybody's civil rights. But you also have to respect the differences among people and encourage children to develop in ways that are appropriate and possible for them. In this country, there is an act called the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which entitles children with disabilities to a free and appropriate public education. Children with disabilities are entitled to such an education, I underline that point, until the age of 21.
Which is older than typically developing children.
Exactly.
So that's important for parents with such children to know.
Exactly. Now, after the age of 21, these children are not entitled to anything. They are eligible for programs, And those programs will be able to provide them services or training or whatever, depending on the available funding, and this varies from state to state. This is a very important point, so that parents whose children are in special education settings will understand that it's not curtains at 18, but there is a time lag whereby the children who might otherwise have gone to a college will have a further few years to help set them, if appropriate, on a vocational track. That's very important to understand. School systems have become enormously strapped for cash, and they've been enormously strapped for people to educate. They don't have enough people in the classrooms, enough support staff to deal with the range of difficulties that teachers are facing in individual schools, with kids who have particular gifts, all the way to those kids who are coming into the school system who don't have a functioning working knowledge of English. And of course, the states have been impressed upon by the federal government that there are certain new standards of achievement that have to be met. What you have is a situation where parents want the best for their children, and that requires a certain amount of support and funding, and it's not always feasible. Parents would be well advised to come in not only with a lot of information, which is what I had, but with a willingness to try and imagine how what they want to be achieved might be achieved, and give some suggestions to the local school authorities about how to make that happen, and where the community could kick in a very creative way is for the parents of typical children to help work and support those families that are usually totally exhausted by the incessant, repetitive demands that a special needs child represents to a person, to an individual parent, but also to the whole family. This would be a very creative solution. Now, can school systems accommodate this? Can they do this? Well, strong PTAs have advocated for these things all along. Principals have to be brought along. Special education staff has to be brought along. But it's not inconceivable that even with limited resources, we can find a way to shuffle the volunteer effort in such a way that the whole community in a typical school, which has pieces for special ed and non-special ed, will be able to meet those demands creatively.
Well, this has certainly been a journey of discovery for you as a parent, I can imagine.
It's a good way to put it, a journey of discovery. I've found myself increasingly resistant to the notion that I'm on a journey, because a journey, it does not necessarily imply a destination or an end. But for me, it has this notion that I'm moving towards something, right? And so I've started using a different notion altogether, which is this is my adventure. I imagine that lots of your listeners would ask or have asked the question, why did this happen to me? What would my life have been like had so-and-so not been born with these disabilities? What would have happened had I not had to deal with these kinds of things? What kind of life would I have led? And I have a very dear friend who to whom I put this question, sort of not with any seriousness. Just a few weeks ago, I said to her, you know, I wonder sometimes what my life would have been like if I had two typically developing children. What might I have done differently? Where might I have gone? And she looked at me and she said, you know, I've often asked myself that question. She's been a victim of polio since she was a child, and she's now 76 years old, and she's an astonishing woman who is quite brilliant and made a career for herself as an economic historian. An economist primarily, but an economic historian. And she said to me, I've often asked myself, what would my life have been like if I hadn't had polio? On the other hand, she added, I wouldn't have been as good a person as I've turned out to be. And I would say the same of myself, that were it not for Alex and what he has taught me in the context of what I have had to learn about disabilities, about an area of life, quite frankly, that I had no particular intellectual or emotional interest in at all until he was born, I've become a better person for this, and I'm very grateful for it.
We're going to leave our listeners, if we can, with some resources. You have mentioned a couple of them, but let's maybe put them all in one spot now so that our listeners, with their pencils handy, can jot down some of these resources for future help.
What I will do is give you resources which will then direct you to further resources. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'll be writing down too many things. I recommend very strongly GMS, G as in George M. Michael S. Sarah Kids, K-I-D-S, www.linda.com, and then you go to links, you will get a whole list of agencies that exist for a variety of things, and you can do a lot of useful research. The other one would be www.icdl.com, which is the Interdisciplinary Council on Developmental and Learning Disorders. And this is a fabulous website that has lots of information and can give you suggestions about further links as well. I have a couple of books that I would recommend. One is Ambiguous Loss by Pauline Boss, and that was published by Harvard University Press in 1999. And the final book that I would recommend is, well, it's a long title, but you could go with the short version, Just Say No, as in K-N-O-W, Understanding and Reducing the Risk of Sexual Victimization of People with Developmental Disabilities, by a man named Dave Hingsberger, who is a Canadian author. He's a maverick. He is a radically interesting and very provocative writer.
Can you spell Hingsberger?
Hingsberger is spelled H-I-N-G-S-B-U-R-G-E-R.
Well, you have given us, over two shows now, an incredible wealth of information and suggestions and, most importantly, hope and support. And so for all of this, Dr. Sari Hornstein, we thank you so much.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity of sharing.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And mention show number 236. Tell us, if you can, what station you're listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you're tuning into. Washington, D.C. with Kids is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents' Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our special appreciation to the Zickler Family Foundation for its generous donation, dedicating this show in loving memory of Sandy Seidel. Our sound engineer is Damon Fisher. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.